I'm sure that, there we go. I can't see any of you. I hope you can see me well. I'm sure you can. For those of you that are joining us here for the first time, this is a session on advancement or development, fundraising for your organization. And it's part of a continuing series. Actually, we're going to begin today to talk about various models for development. And it's building around those models. I think once you understand the models of development, then the implementation of developmental principles becomes a whole lot easier. And so today we're going to be talking about the five-step process of development. There are five steps in this process of development, and understanding those steps is going to be pretty important to your success. But before we do that, let's begin with a word of prayer and ask the Lord's blessing upon our time together, and then we'll get right into the material for this 1.5-hour workshop. Let's pray together, shall we? Father in heaven, thank you for the time and the opportunity that you've granted us to be together. Thank you for Chopron and for what it is that it represents for each of us, an opportunity to be together with friends, people who share the same passions that we share, who have the same desires that we have to develop and to build ministries of impact, sustained ministries that will have impact not just now, but for many years into the future. I pray, Heavenly Father, that you would guide us in our discussion this hour, and that you would enable us to understand what it is that we need to do practically in order to be able to build ministries that are going to be able to have the kind of sustained impact that we long for them to have in reaching people in the ways that we desire to see them reached for you. So guide us, we pray, in our discussion. May you be honored and glorified in the way that we respond to what it is that you have for us in this hour. And to that end, we'll give you thanks, for we pray in the name of Christ our Savior. Amen. Now, for those of you that are kind of new to us, I'm going to, again, kind of lay the groundwork. This is the last time that I'm going to be doing this, but by this time, I think we'll have pretty much everyone on the same sheet of music. The profession that I've spent the last 34 years of my life is called development. Essentially, development is the processes that we use in organizations to build infrastructure to be able to support our ability to be able to do what it is that God's called us to do. That's one of the things that we haven't done typically well in ministry, is build infrastructure. And what infrastructure we have built has been not necessarily built on a solid foundation. And so when the winds and the rains of travail occur, be it economic depression in a particular area of the world or whatever, when those winds of adversity come, we oftentimes lose many organizations because they haven't built an infrastructure sufficient to be able to sustain them during those times of oppression. And so, you know, essentially what it is that I've committed my life to over the last 35 years is helping organizations to do the things that they all know they need to do but just don't really know how to do. And the field has been called historically development, and it includes fundraising things, the kinds of things we do in raising funds for our organization. It includes, you know, the recruitment and the retention of people to be engaged in the support of our organization in the variety of ways in which we require them. It requires that we relate more effectively and objectively to our constituents so that they know who it is that we are. It's public relations. It involves database management, maintaining data on individuals so that we can track emerging relationships. It involves strategic planning, and one of the sessions that we're going to be doing on later in this week is just, you know, how do you plan things in ways that you can be virtually, you know, guaranteed success to the extent that that's, you know, guaranteeing success is really something that we can do, but at least planning things well, not only events and activities, but planning the future of our organization. And then finally, how do we organize ourselves? We defined development yesterday as the things that we do to build relationships with people. And development's all about relationships, and I think that's what makes it so much fun. You know, Jesus was asked the question, what was important? And he responded to his inquisitors by saying, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And it seems to me that there are two very important pursuits of life. You know, one is the pursuit of God. You know, never stop pursuing God. And there are times I looked at my adult sons as I was performing the marriage ceremonies that they were participating in, and I looked at them and their new spouse. And I said, there's going to be times when you're going to feel like giving up on God. There's going to be times when you're not going to feel Him or sense His presence with you. But my challenge to you as you begin your marriage is never give up on God. And even when you feel like you're hanging on by a fingernail or so, still hang on, because God's present and He's going to, perform His will and His character in your life if you allow Him to do that. But the other important pursuit of life is the pursuit of people. And one of the points that I've made several times, some of you have heard it three times now, but I'll make it again, and that is relationships is what development is all about. It's got very little to do with raising money. But to the extent that we build relationships, we'll not lack for money. Development's all about relationships and very little to do with what it is you have to say, but to the extent that you build relationships, what it is that you have to say will be heard. And I think that's just really important to remember. It's fun to kind of look back on our lives, isn't it? And I would encourage you to do that, is to think of all the, monumental decisions that you've made in the context of growing up in your relationship with the Lord. Think of the decisions that you made to pursue ministry, the decisions that you made to do some of the things that have placed you in the environments where you find yourself today. And behind every one of those decisions, you're going to find a person or two, aren't you? You're going to find a mom or a dad that was faithful, or a Sunday school teacher that was, consistent enough in his support and his interest in you that it caused you to make the right decision. There's going to be friends that were there that encouraged you when you needed to be encouraged and helped you and came alongside when you needed to have someone come alongside you. I think that's the whole point, at least, of part of Paul's admonition to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 2. Paul's, last words, the final testament of this one that God had so mightily used in the context of bringing the gospel to so many places around the world of his time. He looks at his young protege, Timothy, and he says, commit to faithful men the things that you've heard among me, that they might be able to teach others also. Because Paul realized the importance of relationships. And the relationship begins, first of all, with young disciples. I'm at a point in my life right now where, discipleship's becoming increasingly important, because I realize that I'm not going to be able to continue to do what it is that I've been doing for the last 35 years, that many years more. And so where I'm really focusing a lot of my attention these days is on, building relationships with young men and seeking to equip them for works of ministry that they can continue what it is that we've begun here. Not for the purpose of just maintaining a business, but for the purpose of spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ in the powerful ways that it needs to be communicated, generating the kinds of impact that we long for it to generate. So development's all about relationships. And so the models that I'm going to be sharing with you over the next two or three days are models that help us to understand how we go about that. And the first model that I'm going to be sharing with you is called the developmental process model. It's just a process of development. It's five steps that we need to follow, and most of us kind of do it intuitively anyway, but I'm going to kind of walk you through the steps and the things that you need to be doing conscientiously as an organization, as you're seeking to build it out for the glory of God. And if development's all about building relationships, then the first step in the developmental process, and the notes are to be found on page 13 of that packet of material that you received, the first step in the developmental process is identifying those people, those individuals with whom you'd like to build a relationship. I mean, that's where it all starts, isn't it? It is identifying individuals with whom you'd like to build a relationship. I was sharing the analogy earlier today that, the development is like falling in love. And the first part of the process is just kind of determining, the kind of person you'd like to spend your life with, and then you start looking around. Yesterday, I shared a little bit of my history. I for a number of years, I served as a chief of staff of a large camping ministry, And every year it was my responsibility to kind of comb through applications of people who were applying to work at our summer camp. And we would hire about 400 of them. Now, there were three camping locations. There was an adult resort, and then there was a teenage camp, and then there was another camp for adolescents. And, you know, essentially, my office was at the adult resort. And so as I was looking through the applications, you know, every application had a picture attached to it. And so as I was kind of looking at the applications, I'd see an attractive young lady who was applying to work on our summer staff, and I'd look at the picture, and if she was really attractive, I'd put her in the adult resort pile. You know, I'd like to have her working close to where it is that I was providing, you know, my ministry. And essentially what I was doing was creating a kind of a dating list for the summer. And that was a lot of fun. But not everybody that I dated I wanted to marry. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a few minutes. But the identification of people with whom you'd like to build a relationship is very important. One of the exercises that I think can be very helpful, and I'm going to talk first of all about some concepts, or in just a few moments about some concepts that we've got listed in your notes, but one of the exercises that I think can be very, very helpful as you look at your organization is to ask yourself this question: what kind of people do you feel would be interested in supporting an organization like yours? What would be some of the characteristics of individuals that would be inclined to think that what it is that you're doing is very, very important? I mean, if you're a school, you might say, well, you know, educators, people who value education, and people who value value-based education. If you're a Christian institution, which of course you would be if you're here at Showprong, you know, people who share the same values, and you might say, well, people who have resources, you know, that match, you know, the profile of the kind of person who might have an interest in supporting you. So the first way to begin the process of trying to think through, you know, individuals with whom, you know, you might want to introduce your ministry is just by, you know, asking yourself the question, well, who would be the groups of people, or what kind of characteristics would those individuals have that might have an interest in supporting me? And then, you know, another question you might ask is, where would you find those people? In other words, where are they? Where would you find people that love the Lord, who are really committed to the values that are important to us, and who might have interest in the things that represent the challenges that we face in reaching people with a unique message to which we've committed ourselves? You might say, well, I've got to find a lot of them in churches, okay? You might find a lot of them in special groups, clubs, or associations that are committed to certain aspects of things that would be somewhat similar to the focus that you take in ministry. You might find them in some communities in service clubs, depending upon the nature of your ministry. If you have service clubs in the community that basically seek to provide support in a variety of ways to organizations that perhaps meet the profile of the organization that you represent. And then the question becomes, well, how can we begin the process of identifying those individuals? And we're going to talk about that in just a few moments. But before we do that, let's go down through our notes, and we've made 3 points here that I think are important to remember. The first one is a term that we use a lot in marketing. It's called universe. A number of years ago, I was taking a position at Grace Theological Seminary in Indiana in the United States. Now, for those of you that may not be familiar with the seminary situation in America, let me just share with you that Grace Theological Seminary in 1967, when I went to seminary, was not a large seminary. We had about 300 students. The most influential and impacting seminary within the context of seminaries in America at the time, and continues to be, probably Dallas Theological Seminary, which was a seminary of probably 5 times as large as what Grace Seminary was. Well, I went to Grace in 1967, and I came back to Grace in 1974 to serve as the director of development, or the vice president for advancement. And when I took that position, I really wanted to do a good job. And I wanted to really represent my Lord well in this new challenge that he'd provided me. I had come to the point of believing that God wanted me to spend my career in development. And so I had identified a number of people around the country that I felt could provide me some help, you know, some counsel. Many of them I knew personally, others I just knew by reputation. One of those people that I knew by reputation was a fellow by the name of John Walvoord Jr. Now, for those of you that have been acquainted with the seminary scene in America, you might recognize that name because John Walvoord Sr. was the president for many, many years of Dallas Theological Seminary, kind of Grace's quote-unquote competitor in providing graduate-level education for those preparing for ministry. Well, John Walvoord Jr. was the president of a major company called Walvoord, Killian, and McCabe. It was a company that was basically committed to providing direct response marketing services to nonprofit ministries throughout the United States. In other words, they did direct mail for organizations like World Vision and Dallas Theological Seminary and, you know, large organizations that were sending out large mailings to constituents around the country. And I felt that I needed to know something about that, so I called John Walvoord, whom I've never met, or who I had never met up to that particular point, and I asked him if I could come and visit with him. He says, "Oh, sure, I'd love to visit with you." So I went to Dallas. And I found where his office was, and it was up in a skyscraper, and he took me to his corporate boardroom, which was kind of intimidating by its very presence. And he set me down, and there was a whiteboard, you know, on the wall. And he began to ask me some questions. The first question he asked me was, well, tell me a little bit about Grace Theological Seminary. And I said, well, we have 347 students, or whatever the case was at that particular time. I says, that would hardly compare with the 1,800 students that are at Dallas Seminary. And he just kind of nodded and kind of went on and asked me another question. He says, well, how many alumni do you have? And I says, well, we have 2,500 alumni. That can't begin to compare with the 25,000 alumni that you have at Dallas Theological Seminary. And he just kind of nodded and shrugged his shoulders a bit. And then he says, well, tell me a little bit about Winona Lake, Indiana. And I kind of smile. I says, well, Winona Lake, Indiana. We have 1,500 people that live in Winona Lake. And he says that, and I said, that could hardly compare with the millions that live in the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex. And he says, stop your whining. And I said, whining? I didn't realize I was whining. He says, no, stop your whining. And he drew two circles on the board, and these circles really impacted me in a very significant way. Maybe they'll impact you as well. But the first circle that he drew on the whiteboard, okay, here we go, was a relatively small circle. And in that circle, he put a person, and he says, now that circle... Or that person, that stick person, represents you, okay? And that circle represents your personal sphere of influence. And he says, now, in your personal sphere of influence, there are people. He says, you have your mom and dad. You have your siblings. Oh, maybe some relatives that... you're pretty close to grandparents and aunts and uncles, and then you have people with whom you went to school and people with whom you went to college and people with whom you currently now work and people with whom you go to church and so forth. And he says, that's your universe. It's composed of people with whom you've built a relationship and with whom you have earned the right to be heard. And he reminded me, as I've reminded many people over the years, that think of your universe as people that you would go to if you had something very important to share, or if you wanted someone's professional opinion on something that you were considering doing. You know, who would you go to? Or if you had a special, you know, medical need and you were going to be facing, a significant surgery at some point in the future, you know, who would you want to pray for you? Who would you ask to pray for you? Well, most of you would probably, if your parents are still living and if they know the Lord, you'd probably call your parents and say, you know, I'd really appreciate your prayers. Or if you needed some counsel, you might go to some friends that you go to college with, or maybe some folks at church that are in a profession that you feel would hold some similarity to what it is that you're doing. You might ask them for counsel, and most of them would hear you. And so John called that the sphere of influence, or he used the word universe. He says we all have a universe, and every individual in this room has a universe, and the size of our universe is going to change depending upon the nature of what it is that we do. I mean, some people who have very high-profile positions, you know, you're pastor of a large church, or you have a an extensive national or international ministry, you might have a larger universe than a person who basically, you know, lives in a relatively restricted area and works within an organization that doesn't have as much influence, say, as the large international or multinational organization. Well, then he drew another circle on the whiteboard that night or that day, and it was a much larger circle. And in that circle, he put a building. And he says that building represents Grace Theological Seminary. He says, now, Grace Seminary impacts a lot of people, a lot of different groups of people. He says, stop and think about the groups of people that are impacted by your ministry. Well, he said, you know, you certainly have students. They're impacted by your ministry. You have the parents of students who are impacted by your ministry. You have alumni who are impacted by your ministry. You have alumni parents who are impacted by your ministry. You have board members and faculty members and staff members, past and present, who are impacted by what it is that you do. You have extended family members of individuals to whom you minister to that have been impacted, at least indirectly, by the services that you provide. You have churches that are impacted by what it is that you do. You have corporations and businesses and the communities where you provide your services. There are foundations and wealthy people in the communities where your ministry is potentially have an impact. He says the realities are there are all kinds of groups within your organization that are impacted by your existence. He says, now in each one of those groups, you have a number of people. And each of those people have a universe of their own. Now, let's say that the average universe of the average person is, say, 20. And that's pretty conservative. It's been estimated to be much higher. But let's say that the average universe of the average person is 20. Well, let's say that you had, in the case of Grace Seminary in those years, we had 25 alumni. And let's say each one of those 25 alumni had a universe of 20. So essentially, you know, you could add that out and you have, you know, 50,000 people, you know, with whom you have the potential of building a relationship. Well, market universe defined is this. Market universe represents the sum total of the individual universes of everyone who's impacted by your organization, either directly or indirectly. So it's a pretty large number, and that's my point. It's a pretty large number. Let me repeat that definition for you again, just in case you didn't get it. That market universe represents the sum total or is the sum total of the individual universes of everyone who's impacted by your organization's ministry, either directly or indirectly. Now, the point is it's a pretty large number. And interestingly enough, it's a calculable number. Now, let me tell you what John did that day, which was kind of the lesson that I needed at that particular point in my career. You see, each one of these groups that he listed in this larger circle, he wrote them on the whiteboard. He said, students and alumni and alumni parents and current parents of students and faculty members, past and present, and extended family members and churches and so forth. And he wrote them all on the board. And we came up with some initial numbers. He says, how many students do you have? And I said, 246. How many alumni do you have? 2,500. How many churches do you have represented in your student body or have had involved in support of your organization over the years? And we had, probably 500, let's say, okay? And then he gave me some rules. He says, okay, here's what I'd like you to assume. I'd like you to assume, first of all, that the average universe of the average person is in this area of the world is 20. And so where you have these kinds of numbers, I just want you to multiply them times 20. Let's look at churches and businesses and things like that in terms of the number of people who might worship there. So let's just assume for the sake of illustration that each one of these churches had 100 people in them. So that's, 5,000. Then multiply that times 20, because assuming that each church member has 20 in their universe. And he says, and I got to go out and do some work in my office. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to come back in about 20 minutes. I've got to make a few phone calls, and I'll come back in about 20 minutes, and I'd like you just to total that up. So he left, and it was kind of a little bit of an awkward situation. I'm here in this big conference room with mahogany walls and a big, huge desk, but I'm walking around, and I'm taking my calculator, and I'm figuring this all out. And it's a little bit more complicated than what I've shown it here, but you're getting the picture. Well, when I total it all up, just about the time I was getting ready to press the equal sign, John walks in. He says, "Well, how are you doing?" I says, "Well, I'm doing pretty well. I'm just about done." And so I got to the point where I pressed the equal sign. He says, "Well, what's the number?" And you know what the number was? 1.2 million people. And I says, "Well, it looks like about 1.2 million people." And he says, "Well, is that enough?" And I said, "Excuse me?" And he says, "Is that enough? If you could build relationships with 1.2 million people, would that be enough in order to be able to do what it is that God's called you to do?" And I said, yeah, I think probably that would be enough. But you know something? It was a changing point in my career. And I hate to, it's a silly story and probably a helpful illustration to show, the obvious, and that is that we don't lack the potential resources to be able to really create the kind of impact that we long to create or provide, through the ministries that, God has given us the privilege of being able to work with. The potential of support is enormous. And while, not all of those 1.2 million people would ever choose to become involved in the support of our organization, many of them would. And just understanding the size of the immensity of the market was incredibly helpful to me, just to kind of think through that. And so think of your organization, and you can kind of create ways on your own to try to define your market universe. But market universe is the legitimate size of the market that you have to share your story to. And knowing that, I think, is pretty important. Now, there's a couple of things about identifying prospects that's pretty important to remember at this particular point in the discussion. First of all, a prospect is not a prospect until you have their name and address written down somewhere. Okay? A prospect isn't a prospect until you have their name and address. It's one thing to say, well, we've got this huge market universe. Our ministry's been around for years. We've ministered to literally, multiplied thousands of people, and obviously each one of those people have a universe of their own, and so our market universe is absolutely gargantuan. It might be, 20 million. But if you don't have any names in your database, and you're not making any concentrated effort to try to build relationships with individuals on that database, then the realities are, that's kind of a wasted effort, isn't it? I mean, it's one thing to know that we've got that size universe, but if we're not doing anything to cultivate that universe, the resources, the mind that essentially God has given us to mine to support our ministry, then we're not going to be effective. So gathering names is an important part of the developmental process. Now, I know that sounds kind of mundane, but, getting names and addresses of people and putting them into a database, but it's pretty important. Now, there's all kinds of ways that you can gather names, and many of you are doing many of these things already. I mean, if you're having if you're receiving checks from people who are supporting your organization, in many instances, the names and addresses of those people who contribute to you is going to be on the check, and you could put that name into the database. Many of you, depending upon the nature of your ministry, you may have registration forms where people would list their names and addresses, and you could put those into your database. Other organizations, there are many organizations, and again, it would be depending upon the nature of your organization, but they have church representative programs, where they have a representative in a congregation who kind of serves as a liaison between your organization and individuals that worship in that particular congregation. And sometimes, one of the challenges to those church representatives would be to identify, influencers in that congregation who might meet a certain profile of the kind of person that typically shows interest in what it is that you're doing. And the first thing you'd like to do is just get their names and addresses. Now, I'm not suggesting that you're going to solicit all those people in support of your organization, but development starts, relationship building starts, with knowing who you'd like to build a relationship with. There are directories that are available that could be valuable to you. You know, there are foundation directories. And in those foundation directories, oftentimes there'll be the names of individuals who are trustees or directors of that foundation. You might theoretically want to see if you could build relationships with those individuals for purposes that I think are probably, you know, pretty clear to most of us. There are annual reports of organizations that have similar nature or similar ministries to you that might list the names of, you know, individuals who have shown interest and support of those organizations and who might have an interest in supporting yours. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to get names. You can get referrals from people on your board. Who are the kinds of people that you know that might have an interest in learning more about what it is we're doing in our organization? There's all kinds of ways of getting names, but it's the first step in the developmental process. You need to get names. Now there's a second step in the developmental process, is what I call qualifying prospects. You know, there's all kinds of ways in which we qualify people. You know, think of my experience of, you know, looking at the staff applications that were coming into the camping ministry where I was serving as the chief of staff. You know, one of the ways that I was qualifying people was on the basis of appearance. You know, if this particular applicant was attractive, and you know, maybe there was some information about, you know, where she was attending college or you know, something in the biographical information that she was providing that was intriguing. You know, so I'd be qualifying people on the basis of something that was pretty subjective, but it was still a way of qualifying people. If I were to look at your donor list, let's say that I, you know, asked you if you could just generate a donor list, that would be helpful for me to kind of look through and kind of evaluate. And I'm happening to go through it, and I noticed that you have a name of a donor in the United States by the name of Bill and Melinda Gates. Now, some of you would recognize that name. Some of you are smiling because you would recognize that name of Bill Gates, who's the president of Microsoft and who happens to be the richest man in the world. And so you've done a little qualification yourself, haven't you? You've said, well, here is somebody who has some financial capability that could really help our organization. And so you have qualified that individual on the basis of what it is that you feel that they could do for you financially. But if you're getting ready to build a new building on your campus, let's say, you're a school and you need to build a new building, and someone walks into your office someday and says, you know, I happen to own, you know, all the lumber yards, you know, here in the country, and my grandchildren are in your school. You're probably making some mental notes here. I think you should be if you're a development person by, you know, thinking to yourself, well, here's a person who might have an interest in you know, providing some in-kind contributions, maybe some of the building materials that we'd require in order to get this building built. So we qualify people all the time. But of all the ways that you could potentially qualify a prospect, all of your prospects are going to fall into one of three broad categories. Those of you that were with us yesterday will remember these categories, but the first of those categories is what I call a nuclear prospect. And a nuclear prospect is a group of people that you've identified who benefit directly from the services you provide. In other words, there are groups within your constituency that benefit, you know, in very meaningful ways by the services that you provide as an organization. For example, you know, you may have, depending upon the nature of your organization, in the case of Grace College and Seminary, I'll use that because I think you'll understand the illustration here, but, you know, I had identified parents and I had identified alumni. You know, these would be parents of current students. We talked, obviously, about current students. And then we had alumni parents. And then we had what we call school family members, and that would include faculty, staff, and board members, past and present. You know, those are all groups that have benefited directly at one time or another as it relates to the ministry that I represent. And you could think of groups of individuals who've been impacted by your ministry. And it's going to depend upon, obviously, the nature of your ministry, how large that group is. or how many groups that would include. Then you have what I call affinity prospects. And an affinity prospect is someone who kind of benefits, but they don't benefit as directly as a nuclear prospect, but they still benefit by your existence. And I think in our case as a seminary, we could think of the churches. The congregations that sent students to our seminary to be trained for works of ministry, and you know, they sent them to our seminary, they entrusted us with the best of what it is they had to offer, and they said, well, we want you to train these people so that they can come back to our church or to establish another church and be used of the Lord to really make an impact in the kingdom of God. And so they were very grateful for our existence because we were providing a service that they couldn't provide, but we were coming alongside them in ways that are compatible with their mission and accomplishing something that they couldn't do, but we could do on their behalf in training and equipping somebody for the kind of work that they sense God was calling them to do. You know, you can be... go on and think of in terms of vendors, the people with whom your organization is doing business. I mean, you're buying products and so forth, and they're benefiting indirectly by your existence. I mean, they're grateful for the fact that you buy paper and that you buy the things that you do in order to be able to sustain your organization's activities. You could look at extended family members. And this oftentimes is the case with certain organizations where extended family members, grandparents and aunts and uncles and all those people that are touched by the lives of these people, those people kind of benefit indirectly. They're just grateful. I know my grandmother, who was a real saint, and she was so happy that I went to Grace Theological Seminary. And she loved Grace, and she loved the impact that it was having on my life, and she was kind of a supporter of Grace because she just felt so good about it. She says, that's the seminary where my grandson goes. And so she was benefiting directly just by the sheer joy that she had in knowing that I was at a place where I was getting the kind of education that was going to enable me to effectively serve God. And so she was kind of an indirect beneficiary. Then we have a third group or a third category, and I call those fringe prospects. And a fringe prospect is someone who lives geographically in the area where you provide your services, or someone who has or provides services that are somewhat analogous to yours, but, for instance, a foundation, a charitable foundation or a charitable trust. You know, that gives to organizations that meet the profile of your organization, but they're located in Atlanta, Georgia, or they're located in Dallas, Texas, or someplace. And you don't know them, but you know that they support ministries that meet the kind of profile that would describe your organization. And so they represent a fringe prospect or a corporation or a business that you know support organizations that would be similar in nature to what it is that you provide. So it would include corporations, businesses, and what I'm doing here is I'm actually separating by making that distinction corporations from smaller, you know, mom and pop businesses that may exist in a community, that don't have large corporate entities, but they are obviously providing commerce for a particular geographic area. You have foundations and charitable trusts. And, even wealthy people. And again, it's going to be depending upon the organization. But I remember at Grace Seminary in college when I was serving there that one of my habits, you know, just I think probably this is one of the habits of people in the industry that I'm involved in. But, you know, I'd read the newspaper, and I'd read the Chronicle of Philanthropy, and I'd read the Chronicle of Higher Education. And I always read it with curiosity because, I'd kind of look and see where people were making grants. In the local newspaper, oftentimes, and maybe your newspaper does this, you know, there's somebody that's making a charitable contribution to someone, and so there's a picture of someone shaking hand with the CEO of that organization, and they're receiving a check. And occasionally I would see somebody that was, giving a check to an organization, someone of our local residents in the community where I lived. They were handing the president of the Indiana University Foundation a check for $10 million. I kind of look at their address and it's three houses down from our seminary. And I'm thinking, my gracious, I mean, here's somebody that lives three houses down from where I, you know, my seminary is located, and they just gave $10 million to an organization 300 miles away. I mean, that $10 million could have been used very, very effectively by our organization, but I didn't even know they existed, and they didn't know, for all practical purposes, what we were all about. And so when they had the opportunity or they had the need to give away money, then the realities are it was focused in the area where somebody had built a relationship with them or where an organization with whom they had very close linkage. So prospects will fall into one of these three broad categories. Now, in your notes, I talk about the rule of linkage. And let me just share with you a little bit about the rule of linkage. And some of you that were with me yesterday, I apologize. I guess there is a little bit of repetition here, but just kind of hang in with me. This is good repetition. You know, repetition is a key to good learning. And so let me just share with you a little bit about the rule of linkage. It's the most important rule of development. There are all kinds of rules in development. You know, one of them is the rule of linkage. And the rule of linkage, simply stated, is this: the closer someone is linked to you, the greater the likelihood that they'll support you. Now, that's not rocket science. I mean, you could figure that out on your own. You didn't need to have me come all the way from America to tell you that. But the realities are most of us don't think too much about it as it relates to what it is we do in the trying to gain support for our ministries or organizations. But the closer someone is linked to you, the greater the likelihood that they'll support you. So if you're looking at these three groups, nuclear groups and affinity groups and fringe groups, as you're looking at these three groups, which category would you expect to receive the most support from? And I think most of you would agree that it would probably be in this nuclear category. Why? Because you have very close linkage here. The further you go down, the weaker the linkage. And so down here, interestingly enough, there's very little likelihood, practically speaking, that you're going to be able to cultivate, you know, the resources that are in this mine because you don't have a lot of linkage here. And yet, they're interestingly enough, if you were to look at these three categories in terms of potential, which group has the most financial potential, practically speaking, is probably the groups down here, isn't it? These are the people that have resources. I mean, they have significant resources, but we've got a problem. We've got people with resources without linkage. And so the consequence is that we're probably not going to get a lot of that money unless we do something. So there's two subpoints under this rule of linkage. And so let me give you the two subpoints, and they're important to understand. The first of the subpoints is this. There's two kinds of linkage. There's natural linkage, and there's created linkage. The story that I told you yesterday is that I have natural linkage with my two sisters. I have two older sisters. I was terribly abused as a child. And, you know, having two older sisters is a real problem. Some of you are younger siblings. You know exactly what I'm talking about. I was beat up, and, you know, and my sisters were my babysitters, and they were always tattling on me when I did something wrong. But I had two older sisters, and it happens to be that I was born on Christmas Day. I already told some of you that today, and my sisters would like to still believe that it was Santa Claus that brought me to the house that Christmas morning in 1944, you know, because they figured that was the only rational explanation for their brother. You know, somebody had to come from the North Pole or someplace, you know, kind of land the old sled on the roof and then drop the bundle of joy down the chimney. There on Christmas morning showed up our brother. You know, he was there on the hearth of the fireplace when we got up to look for our presents that morning. But you know something, the realities are I could point like my sisters to my parents and say, well, I'm the product of that relationship too. Okay? Because, you know, these are my birth parents like your birth parents. And so we have natural linkage. We are linked together by that common bond of having the same parents. Well, just like there's natural linkage, there's also created linkage. If my parents had chosen to adopt a child, let's say that there was a child that came up for adoption. You know, mom and dad had, you know, passed away, maybe in an accident or something like that. And now, you know, this child is needing a home, and my parents become so moved by that they adopt them into the family. Well, through the adoptive process, what happened? They became part of our family. Some of you have adopted children, perhaps, in your home, or maybe your children have adopted children. And you're saying, well, these are my grandkids, you know, and maybe they weren't naturally born by your daughter and son-in-law or vice versa, but they were adopted, but that doesn't really change anything, is it? They're part of the family now. And so through the adoptive process, we create linkage. Well, it's a very important developmental concept because the question that we need to answer in development is this: how can I, speaking on your behalf, how can I create linkage with someone with whom I don't have it naturally? You see, with these groups of people, you don't have natural linkage, and so the question that you must answer, you've got to answer this question, is how can I create linkage with these groups of people with whom I don't have it naturally? Are there things that I can do to create linkage with these people? Recognizing that through the creation of linkage, I increase the likelihood of their ongoing participation in what it is that we're doing. And we're not just talking about money. And I realize that we talked a little bit about money early on, but the realities are this is how relationships are built. And we need to create linkage. Now, there are all kinds of ways that you could create linkage, and I shared some of these with you yesterday. I think one way that you might want to create linkage with people who worship in churches who are impacted in one way or another by the ministry that you provide is providing them the opportunity to become prayer partners. You know, wouldn't it be something if there were, you know, 500 or 1,000 or 10,000 or, depending upon the nature of your ministry, you know, multiplied thousands of people who are supporting you regularly by praying? Now, in my book, Funding Your Vision, which is the book that I wrote that basically incorporates most of what it is that I'm sharing with you, and I'll give you a copy of that book on a CD, okay? You can print it out and do whatever you want with it. And if you'd like to get a hard copy, I'd be more than happy to send you one. But in my book, Funding Your Vision, I tell a story. It's an allegory. The whole book is an allegory, and it's basically two people interacting with one another. You know, one of the people that's talking in the book is a fellow that I have identified as the frustrated man. Maybe you kind of meet the qualifications of the frustrated man or frustrated woman. This frustrated man is involved in a ministry that's making a huge difference in the lives of a lot of people. Like many of your organizations, I've heard many of your stories and how you're impacting people, and people's lives are being changed and directions of whole families are being turned in a very positive way towards God and righteousness, and you're making a huge difference. And most people that you talk to recognize that. In fact, they're so excited. Well, we're so grateful for your school. You've already heard that, I'm sure, many times where people come to you and they say, we're so grateful for your ministry. You're such a godsend to us, and thank you so very much. But they don't tend to come forward to support you in any kind of a meaningful way. And so, consequently, you're frustrated. Many of you came to Chopron frustrated because you know you represent a ministry that's making a huge difference in the lives of a lot of people, but how do we get people excited about it to the point where they're going to come alongside and be a part of what it is we're doing? So you're frustrated. Well, the frustrated man meets a person in the book called the visionary. Now, the visionary is kind of someone that's kind of been there and done that, okay? He's been involved in a ministry. He's learned how to build relationships, and ministries with whom he's been associated have flourished and have grown and have become capable of achieving their potential and so forth. And so he's called the visionary. Well, the frustrated man meets the visionary, okay? And so most of the book is the two conversing with one another, and they're learning from one another what it is that they need to know in order to be able to help in ways that would be compatible with the need. Well, in one of the scenes in the book, the frustrated man walks into the office of the visionary. And the visionary happens to be sitting at a roll-top desk. I think you're all familiar with roll-top desks. They're wonderful. I have a roll-top desk, and I just love it, you know, because it has all these little cubby holes in it, and I just love cubby holes. And so the visionary kind of calls the frustrated man over to the roll-top desk. And he says, do you know why people like roll-top desks? Well, of course, you know, the visionaries, the frustrated man is saying, you know, is this a trick question? Or I'm not sure. I guess because they like roll-top desks. And the visionary concurs, but he says people like roll-top desks because they like cubby holes. Now, that's a very important point, I think, from a developmental standpoint, that people like cubby holes. You know, I love my roll-top desk because I have a little section of my desk. One of the things that I have done over the years, it's one of the little habits that I have, which makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. But I have saved, and I'm not consistent in doing it like I used to be, quite frankly, but for years I had saved every boarding pass of every airplane flight I had ever been on. I mean, I just tear it off and put it into my billfold. When I get home, I'd kind of throw it into that little cubby hole. And at the end of the year, I'd bundle them all up and I'd show them off to my kids, you know, and say, look, this is where Dad's been this year. They'd all get, oh, wow, Dad, that's just so neat, you know. And then they'd kind of look through them. They'd say, well, I didn't know you went here, and I don't remember ever getting anything. So that's when I stopped putting, you know, saving them. Because they were keeping records about all the presents they were getting from various, you know, places in the world that I'd been. But people like cubbyholes. People like to be able to plug into things. And I think one of the keys to effective development is preparing and creating cubbyholes for people. One of the points that I made yesterday, and I'll make this point again, so you're going to hear it again and again and again. I'm kind of like that. But one of the points that I made yesterday is that there are two things, two assumptions that we make in ministry, and both of these assumptions are wrong. The first assumption that we make in ministry that is wrong is that when we speak and when we say something about our organization, that everybody understands what it is that we're talking about. That they just figure it all out. They say, oh, yeah, that's it. That's wonderful. This is an organization. Here are the ways that I could help the organization. They just got it all figured out from the very beginning. Well, let me tell you something. And this is what I told the group yesterday, and I'll probably tell you again tomorrow, and that is that if you believe that, you've never had a teenager live in your house. If you believe that when you say something, everybody gets it and all the ramifications of what that represents, then you've never had a teenager live in your house. I mean, I raised two sons, and, you know, fortunately and gratefully, they're still alive, which is really kind of amazing in and of itself. They're 36 and 34 now, and now they have children of their own, and they're scratching their heads because they're looking at their children. They said, Dad, they just don't get it. They just don't get it. I says, you didn't either. I mean, I hate to tell you, but you didn't get it either. Okay? The other assumption that we make that is wrong is that even assuming that they get it, in other words, you go and you present your ministry and you talk about your needs and you talk about what it is that God's doing through your ministry, you can't assume that they just figure it all out. Well, I could pray for them, or I could give to them, or they're going to need some volunteers in order to be able to effectively accomplish what it is they've committed themselves to do. They're going to need these kinds of resources. You can't assume that anybody's going to draw all those conclusions, or they're going to expend the energy to come up with assumptions that basically represent your needs. You can't assume that. So a cubbyhole is essentially providing opportunities for people to plug in, okay? And we're going to talk more about this concept in a session tomorrow. But just be reminded of this. When you're talking to a group of people and you're sharing the ministry of your organization to people, you know, you might want to say, well, there are several ways that you could be a part of what it is that God's doing in our organization. So let me share with you some of the ways that you could really be a help to our ministry. Number one, you could become a prayer partner. And it's one thing to say, and this is really important, I think, from a developmental standpoint, it's one thing to say you could pray for us. And if you were to ask people if they would be willing to do that by a show of hands, you know what I would probably expect? That the majority of them would say, sure, count on me as a prayer partner. And you know how many are going to actually pray for you on a regular basis? Probably a very infinitesimal fraction of those people. Because you didn't give it priority, they're not going to give it priority. And so if you feel that prayer is an important part of your ability to be able to accomplish what it is that God's calling you to do, then give prayer a priority. And what I mean by giving it a priority is say, we have a program. We have a cubbyhole for people who would like to pray. And we call it our Prayer Partners Network. And if you would like to sign up for our Prayer Partners Network, just check that box in the card that I've provided for you. And the very fact that somebody checks a box and puts their name down reflects that they're making a very important decision in terms of a commitment to your organization. They're saying, I'm going to pray for you. Now, what I would do is I'd send them a 30-day prayer guide. Maybe you just write it on a sheet of paper, something that they can just scotch tape to their refrigerator. Maybe you put it on a magnet. Maybe you send out periodic prayer reminders via email or whatever. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that you could do it, but you are giving it priority. You're saying it's important, and it's important enough for us to provide the resources that people need in order to be able to intelligently pray. You see, it's one thing to say, you know, will you pray for us? So everybody raises their hands. But then they don't know how to pray for you. Lord, bless Ravi Zacharias Ministries. Well, great. I mean, I'm sure that the Lord hears that prayer, and he probably does bless Ravi Zacharias' ministry. But the realities are Michael's doing an evangelistic crusade in Bucharest. And that's what we really want people to pray for right now, because that's where Michael is, and that's where the Spirit of God, we're praying that the Spirit of God is going to work, and that's what we want people to pray for. Then you've got to provide them that kind of information, because otherwise they're just not going to know. So programs, and I call anything like a Prayer Partners Network a program. And essentially a program is anything that you create that basically prioritizes something that you perceive to be very, very important. A Prayer Partners Network. We have a lot of our organizations that do Habitat for Humanity. They do this around the world, but they have senior auxiliaries. You know what they've discovered? And I think it's really kind of interesting, but they've discovered that senior citizens, you know, have a lot of time on their hands. And they're looking, many times, at least in our country, they're looking for things to do, ways to become engaged in helping others, and they've got time and they've got experience. And so Habitat for Humanity says, well, golly, I mean, here's a group of people that we would like to become, you know, supporters of our organization. We'd like to engage them. And so they began a program. They call it the Seniors Auxiliary. And basically, you know, how do you become a member of the Seniors Auxiliary? Check a block on a card. I mean, that's how you become a member. And then, you know, these auxiliaries have functions. You know, they provide refreshments. For every time Habitat for Humanity builds a home, you'll notice that they have, you know, meals served. Well, who's preparing all those meals? Well, the Seniors Auxiliary. If you come onto a building site, of a Habitat building site, you're going to have people that are going to greet you. You know, who are going to be the hosts and hostesses that receive you and greet you when you come and give you instructions on what to do? It's going to be members of the Seniors Auxiliary. Whenever they have an activity like a home dedication, who are the people that are coordinating much of what it is that happens there, the coordinating the decoration of a home or whatever the case might be? It's members of the Seniors Auxiliary. But essentially, by creating a Seniors Auxiliary, by creating a cubbyhole, they've provided and they've given importance to a group of people that they recognize as being important to the ability of their organization to fulfill its mission. Many organizations have student sponsorship programs. You know, many organizations, you know, like Compassion International, have sponsorship programs where you can sponsor a child. And it's a program. You know, it's one thing to say, well, how'd you like to, you know, sponsor a child by praying for them on a regular basis and maybe sending a check once a month or so? Well, I mean, any number of people might raise their hand to that, but the realities are probably few are going to follow through. So you need to give it prominence, and that's why cubbyhole. So the question becomes, how can I create linkage? Look at each one of these groups and ask yourself the question, how could I create linkage with corporations? How can I create linkage with corporations? Many organizations create linkage with corporations by beginning a corporate partnership program. Do you have businesses in your community? Do you have businesses or corporations that are represented by individuals, you know, who benefit from the services you provide? I mean, could you begin a corporate partnership program? What would a corporate partnership program? It might mean giving money. It might mean supporting a particular initiative. In America, we have a lot of corporations that will take on in Christian schools, they will take on the responsibility of sponsoring a class, you know, the third grade, and there may be some some financial obligations that they are willing to assume. There may be other things that they're willing to assume, but they're taking some ownership, practically speaking, of what it is you're doing by their participation in a corporate partnership program. But the question becomes, and one of the most important questions that we must respond to, is how do we create linkage with people with whom we don't have it naturally? Because the closer we create linkage, the greater the likelihood. The likelihood exponentially increases that these people, when presented opportunities to become involved, are going to say yes to you. I mean, we could, you know, I think yesterday I gave a little bit of a test, and one of the tests that I gave was, you know, let's assume that we're going to send out, let's assume that for the sake of illustration, that Habitat for Humanity is going to send out a year-end letter. Many of you send out year-end letters, appeals to donors and prospects, people on your database, for a special Christmas offering to help you to accomplish what it is you've committed yourself to do. So let's say that Habitat for Humanity chooses to send out a Christmas offering. They do that every year in December. And they send out a letter and they're asking people to respond. Let's say that they're going to send it to seniors, you know, members on their database who kind of qualify as senior citizens. And maybe let's say there's 1,000 of them for the sake of illustration. 500 of them of the 1,000 are members of the Seniors Auxiliary and 500 aren't. You know, which ones would you expect to be more likely to respond to that appeal? And most of you would say, well, the members of the Seniors Auxiliary. Why? Because linkage was created. There's a sense in which they've taken on some ownership of what it is that you're doing. See, people assume that, you know, well, golly, because this organization exists, there must be somebody behind it that's providing all the resources, and so I don't need to become involved. And so it's important for us to communicate to people, you know, the ways in which they can become involved in what it is that we're doing. And cubbyholes, you know, think of it as cubbyholes, things that we provide that provide people those opportunities. There's one other note that I would like to make here as it relates to a qualification. You notice that I have groups and development strategy. You notice that when we put them down, as we wrote down nuclear affinity and fringe, we talked about groups, didn't we? We talked about parents. We talked about corporations. We talked about extended family members. Those are all groups. There are people that are part of those groups. From a developmental standpoint, it's very, very important to think about groups, because it's easier to strategize around groups, to develop development strategy around groups. In other words, what are we going to do in terms of grandparents? Are there ways that we might be able to, you know, create linkage with that group of people? Or you might say that there are physicians, you know, that have benefited in a significant way by the nature of your organization. And so you're looking at that group of people and you're saying, well, how can I create linkage with that group? So rather than creating, you know, if 10,000 plans for the 10,000 people on your database, you're developing strategy around, you know, 13 groups that you've identified and recognized and being critical to your future. So I call them critical groups, any group of people that you perceive as being critical to your success. So first of all, you identify groups, and then you prioritize those groups in terms of their relative importance. And that's going to change from year to year, because some groups are going to be more important in some years than others by virtue of some of the initiatives that you might be involved in. Now, the next discussion is on cultivation. And again, in the pre-forum, we talked about this, and so I'm going to kind of go quickly through it. But cultivation, I don't want to go so quickly through it that we miss its significance. It's courtship. See, if one of the analogies of the development is falling in love, you know, think of cultivation as courtship. See, when I asked Sue to marry me, I knew she was going to say yes. I mean, it wasn't a mystery. It wasn't like I was sitting there on my knees reading this poem to her thinking, like, what am I going to do if she says no? I mean, I knew she was going to say yes. And she was kind of wondering whenever I was going to get around to asking. She was going to think, when is he going to do this? Because, see, we talked about getting married. We talked about spending our lives together. We talked about how we could more effectively serve God together than we could alone. And so when I asked her to marry me, you know, I knew she was going to say yes. So for the sake of illustration, let's say that Sue, in that particular, if we were going to categorize prospects, you know, in terms of readiness, she was an A prospect. She was ready to go. Now, I could have asked her to marry me before she was really ready to consider that. Maybe after 4 or 5 dates, she might have been a B prospect then. I mean, we've had good times. We've had good talks. We're kind of feeling like, oh, maybe we are compatible. But she still needs some questions answered before she can make this lifelong commitment that I'm asking her to make. Well, let's say I ask her after one date. Well, you're saying she's probably not going to be too likely to say yes. I mean, it might have been a nice time, but the realities are there's too many unanswered questions. So let's call her a C prospect. Well, let's say I meet her in the grocery store for the first time, and I know she doesn't have a wedding ring on. I think she's cute, and so I just tap her on the shoulder and say, well, would you like to marry me? And she hits me over the head with a milk carton. You know, marry you, I don't even know you, and that's the point. She doesn't even know me, and so there's very little likelihood of any that she'd ever say yes to my invitation to marry. So you have what I call, in the context of development, let's say this is a developmental prospect, you have people that are in varying degrees of cultivation. Some are A's, some are B's, some are C's, and some are D's. Now, over here, you have what I call varying degrees of vestiture. You know, some people are vested in your ministry. They've been volunteers. They've supported you. They've served you. They've come alongside in a variety of ways throughout the years in the support of your organization. So they're vested. They know who it is you are. They believe in what it is that you're doing. They have confidence in your ability to be able to accomplish your objectives and so forth. So they feel pretty good about you. So they're vested. Well, there are other people that you're going to identify, other groups that you're going to identify that have no vestiture whatsoever. They don't even know perhaps that you exist. They've never invested anything in your organization. So it's the combination of these things that can be either lethal or, you know, very, very positive in your pursuit of engaging support for your organization. But if you have a majority or preponderance of people on your database that are non-vested and they're D prospects, then the likelihood is you're probably not going to be successful in engaging them in meaningful ways in helping you to fulfill your mission. I mean, they're not vested and they don't know anything about you. So you send them out appeals and they don't respond and you wonder why. Well, I mean, I think it's probably pretty clear why they didn't respond. A number of years ago, we came up with an acronym within our organization. And it's kind of a helpful acronym. It's the word AID, A-I-D. A stands for attendance. I stands for involvement, and D stands for donation. You see, there's the three ways in which people can become involved in the support of your organization. They could attend something that you're doing. And don't minimize the significance of that. If you're doing a crusade like Michael does, you know, it might be important for Michael periodically, maybe at some time during the crusade, if it's a multi-day crusade, to maybe get together with groups of people. You know, before or after the crusade, before to just pray and ask the Lord's blessing upon the time, and afterwards just to mix and to share and to pray more, you know. But, you know, getting those times together could be pretty important. Attendance, you know, people can come to activities, they can participate in special events, you can kind of create special events to give them the opportunity of being able to be exposed to what it is that you do. But don't minimize the significance of that. Yesterday, I told a story about InterVarsity. We supported InterVarsity Christian Fellowship in Colorado because our son, as a student at the University of Colorado, was incredibly impacted by that incredible ministry. And there was a couple, Todd and Nanette Nice. It's an interesting name, isn't it? Nice, N-I-C-E. And the Nices were so nice to our son. And they just kind of invited him in their home, and they loved him, and they encouraged him, and they were just incredible people. Well, you know, we became aware of some financial needs that they have, so we'd started supporting them, and we supported them for years. We continue to support them. They're still there, and our son's been out of college for probably 15 years now, and we continue to support the Nices. They're still doing the work of InterVarsity in Colorado. Well, you know, one of the things that the Nices did, which was a nice thing, we could really go a long way with this, couldn't we? But one of the things that they did every year is they'd come to visit us when we lived in Colorado, and they'd take us out to lunch. And one of the questions they asked us one time was, is there something, you know, more that we need to do to thank you and express appreciation for all that you do for us and for the ministry? And I said to them, I said, you know what I'd like to do? I says, I'd like to come to something that you do. I mean, they'd oftentimes have retreats where they'd bring college students to, you know, mountain hideaways, and they'd have these weekend retreats. And you know what I want to do? I just wanted to go and to experience it. You know, so what would be more wonderful if there's a pre-campaign meeting before one of Michael's campaigns, and they're just training, you know, some of the volunteers to, you know, respond to those people who have expressed interest and wanting to know more about the Lord and how they might move into relationship with him. Well, you know, what nicer thing could he do than to invite a few key people around, you know, the area to come alongside and just be a part of that, to observe what it is that we're doing, the things that go behind the scenes in preparing for a campaign and for the spiritual impact that we love to see as a result of those things that we do. Okay? So attendance. People can become involved. They don't have to give, but they can become involved. You're going to need volunteers. You're going to need people to work in helping you to cultivate certain critical groups that you identify. When we talk about organization at the end of the week, you're going to discover that there are far more involvement opportunities than you possibly could have imagined. You know, some of you are thinking, well, gosh, there's only so many things that people could be involved in doing. We've got 12 things that I can think of. Well, by the end of the week, you're going to think of 150 things that people could be involved in. Or maybe 300 or 500 or thousands of things. In other words, you don't lack for ways in which to productively and creatively engage people, and you need to kind of think through those. Okay, and then people could make a donation, couldn't they? Well, we came to this conclusion that if somebody had done all three, they equal an A. If they've done two of the three, they equal a B. If they've done one of the three, they equal a C. If they've done none of the three, they equal a D. Well, we also concluded that exponentially the likelihood of a D prospect to support you in whatever way you might want to engage them in the support of your organization was about zero. A 0% likelihood. There's about a 30% likelihood that a C prospect would say yes to your invitation to become engaged in the support of your organization, whatever that invitation might be. It might be a giving opportunity, or it might be just an invitation to become involved as a volunteer. There's a 60% likelihood that a B prospect would, and a 90% likelihood that an A prospect would. So it occurred to me early on in ministry, you know, here's a guy that wants everybody to like him, okay? I mean, you may not agree with me on everything, but I sure hope that you'd like me by the time this week is over. And you say, well, gee, Jerry's a nice guy. He just is kind of crazy. But I'd hope that you'd like me. Well, here's a guy that wants everybody to like him, who's been in a profession for the last 35 years where I've talked to tens of thousands of people about investing in ministry, and I feel rejected every time someone says no to me. Now, how in the world have I survived for 35 years? Well, one of the things that I learned early on, almost intuitively, was I'd never ask a girl to marry me in the grocery store. Okay. In other words, I wanted to make sure that the people that I spent my time talking to and seeking to engage in the support of my organization were people that had been cultivated to the point where there was at least a relatively strong likelihood that they were going to say yes to my appeals. So we need to cultivate, and the best way to cultivate is think through that acronym. Is there places that we could invite people to come? Now, ask yourself that question. Just explore all of those options. And it doesn't have to be a formal event. It could be an informal event. You can invite somebody to come to lunch. One of the things we used to do at Grace College and Seminary a number of years ago, we used to call it the Tuesday luncheon. Now, I bet you probably know what day of the week that occurred, that luncheon. It always occurred on Tuesday. And it was on Tuesdays when the president was in town. And every week the president was in town during the school year, we would have a secretary invite five or six people over for lunch at the school. Well, you know, these people, prominent business people, presidents of service clubs, I mean, you know, there were just all kinds of groups that we could identify that we wanted to have people represented on those Tuesday luncheons, and they would come. They'd first of all meet in the president's office, and then they'd walk down to the dining commons, and they'd go through and grab a salad and go back into a private dining room, and the president would just greet them. It wasn't a fundraiser. He'd just say, well, we're so glad to have you here, and we just kind of wanted to show you what it is that the Lord's doing around here. And he'd talk about the school. He did such a great job in talking about the school. And, you know, usually a student would come in serving the entree. We've done this in a lot of organizations where the seniors, you know, auxiliary, in some instances, will come and serve the meal. They just love doing that, pampering people. But the president would ask, you know, if they have any questions. And then he'd say, well, there's several ways that you could plug into what it is we're doing. And he'd talk about some things that they might want to consider as they're evaluating what it is that they might want to do, if anything, in relationship to the organization. But I remember one guy that came Tuesday luncheon. He was the president of a large corporation. He was a graduate of a major institution, had a degree in nuclear physics or something. He was just a brilliant, brilliant man who'd lived in the community for years. And as he's looking around, he kind of has a stunned look on his face. He just kind of, you know, he obviously is troubled by something. And finally, the president looks at him and he says, well, Tom, he says, what are you thinking? What are you thinking as you're hearing all of this about our organization? And he says, well, I thought this was a monastery. I mean, he had lived in that community for probably 20 years. And his background, seminary, meant monastery, because he was Catholic in background. And he thought that there were just a bunch of guys walking around in robes baking bread or something up there. He didn't know what we were. And all of a sudden, just that opportunity of being exposed provided him the opportunity of learning more about what it is we're doing. You can't assume that everybody knows about your organization just because you maybe said something about it somewhere along the way, that they've got it all figured out. So kind of think through those attendance opportunities. All right, the next step in the process is, and I shared some cultivation ideas yesterday, and we'll maybe get into some of those tomorrow, but I want to try to finish this set of notes. The next one is solicitation. You know, asking people to become involved. And now let me give you, we've got to run through a lot of this. We've just got a few more minutes, and so... And tomorrow, for those of you that are come back, I'll finish up this set of notes if I don't get it complete here today. But there's another rule of development that's a pretty important rule to remember. And it's called the rule of communication. So let me kind of repeat the rule of communication real quickly to you. The rule of communication, simply stated, is this. One-on-one is best. The further you remove yourself from that ideal scenario, the least likely you'll get the response that you want. You see, the realities are that if I want Tim to support my ministry by praying for me, you know, the best thing I could do is to say, hey, Tim, you know, we've got some special needs at the organization and ministry, and I'd like you to consider being one of our prayer partners. Is that something that you'd be willing to consider? Well, he's nodding his head yes, so I'm assuming that he'd be willing to consider that. And the realities are that's wonderful. But the moment I expand my audience and say, you know, we've got some great needs in our organization, and we just need a lot of help, you know, from a lot of people just like you to pray for us on a regular basis. And I hope that some of you will consider doing that. Of course, Mark's hearing this over here. And, you know, what typically that does, let's say I'm asking people to consider a contribution. So Mark's, you know, hearing this financial need that I've just made, you know, an expression of. And immediately what typically will happen is Mark will go immediately to prayer. He says, Lord, I just want to pray for Tim because I know Tim's got a lot of money. And Tim's praying for Mark, and Mark's praying for Michael, and Michael's praying for Neil. Everybody's praying for everybody else, and nobody's getting the point except you. You're getting the point, aren't you? That if you want someone to support you, if you want someone to give you $500,000, if you want somebody to work with you on a work project or whatever, the best thing you could do is just ask them face to face. Because the further you remove yourself from that ideal scenario, the law of likelihood goes down. Now, I have learned over the years that one of the best ways to ask people to involve or to engage in your organization is to present to them a proposal, something that communicates objectively your needs in a way that's clearly understandable, that's personalized to them, and it states information about your organization that would allow them to make an informed decision in support of you. And I call it the personalized proposal. And all of you can do this. You should write one up immediately. If you haven't written one, you should. Something that states in 2 or 3 pages important information about your organization that would allow people to understand the opportunities for them to become involved and essentially ask them to become engaged in what it is that you're doing. So let me tell you the 6 things that need to be included in every personalized proposal. And we're rushing through this, obviously, and I apologize for that. But when we see people moving, then that will be our signal, okay? Because if they're late, if we can just beat them, we get a floor, okay? We get a floor to catch up because they have to come down one set of stairs. So here are the 6 things that need to be included in a personalized proposal from my perspective. Number 1, you need to talk about your mission. Mission is the essence of rationality. So start talking to people about who it is you are and what it is you're all about. Number 2, I think every personalized proposal needs to talk about your history, where you've come from. You know, if you've got a story to tell, tell the story about the impact that your ministry has had in the lives of people. Use statistics and charts and graphs to illustrate that so that people can see that this ministry is making an impact and has made an impact historically in the lives of individuals. Thirdly, share with them your vision for the future. You know, ask yourself the question, what are we looking like, or what would we look like 10 years from now if we were totally successful in accomplishing what it is we've committed ourselves to do? You know, and then begin to paint that picture in ways that are going to hopefully capture the imagination of those with whom you're speaking. Let me share with you what our community would look like. Let me share with you what our country would look like if we were 100% successful in accomplishing what it is that God had called us to do, and kind of show them the vision. Number four, talk to them about your strategic plan, because you better have a plan to achieve that vision. One of the points that I make and probably have made, I know I made it yesterday, I don't know if I made it in our network session this morning, but a plan, a vision without a plan, a quantifiable plan, you know, that states in quantifiable terms the steps that you're going to take to move your organization from where it is today to where it is that you want it to be, you know, a vision without a plan is nothing more than a good idea. So you need to have some specificity how you're going to accomplish what it is you've committed yourself to do. And it may be that, you know, you're going to be doing this and you're going to be increasing your enrollment here and you're going to be increasing your budget here in order to be able to do this here and so forth. But people need to see the plan. Then they need to see the immediate need. There's something that we talk about in development. It's called contextual development. And essentially what it means is this, is that people need to see today what it is that's happening today in the context of where it is you're going. In other words, you know, what people see at any given time about your ministry is only a picture. It's a snapshot of what it is that you're doing today. But they need to see how it fits into a bigger vision of what it is that you're seeking to accomplish. Why would Michael go to Bucharest and the next year go to Budapest and the next year go to Kiev and the next year go to, you know, Minsk or some other place? Why would he do that? Because it's a part of an overall strategy that we have to reach this area of the world with the message that we have of God's redemptive love. And it's a part of a bigger plan, because out of that evangelistic crusade, there will be small groups that will be established and there will be initiatives that will be working and going to universities and so forth. People need to see the big context that you've thought beyond tomorrow, because most people don't think beyond tomorrow. But they want to have the assurance that you have thought beyond tomorrow, and that what it is they give to today, what it is they support today, is a part of a bigger plan of what it is that you as an organization have committed yourself to do. So you need to talk about the immediate need, and then you need to ask the question. Let me share with you ways that you could be a part of this, and provide, you know, a variety of ways. You know, what I've discovered over the years, and I think this is true, is that everybody wants to say yes to you. Very few people want to say no. I don't find it particularly comforting to say no to somebody who comes to me earnestly with a request. But if the only request that they give to me is, would you give $100,000? Well, I might have to say no, because I might not be in a position to be able to do that. And so, you know, give people an alternative of ways, a number of ways that they could be a meaningful part in enabling you to accomplish what it is that you need to do. Personalize the proposal. Keep it down to 2 to 3 pages. Use graphs, pictures, charts, anything to kind of separate it out in such a way that it has white space and it's appealing to the eye. Give it to people, typically with a request to respond by a certain time frame. There are 2 reasons why people don't give when they're asked to give. One reason they may not give is because they didn't perceive they were being asked. And so, you know, the proposal kind of eliminates that, doesn't it? Because, I mean, here's a proposal that has your name on it. This is something we're asking you to consider. But another reason why they may not give is because you didn't give it enough urgency. You didn't bring closure to the appeal. And so oftentimes when I'm talking to someone, you know, about contributing or making a commitment to our organization, I might say something like, you know, we'd like you to prayerfully consider this. And I realize that in order to prayerfully consider this, you're going to need a little time. But I'd like you to pray about this. And, you know, would it be possible for me to get back to you maybe at the end of the week or a couple of weeks from now? You know something? I've never had anybody say no to that request. They may have readjusted the date to accommodate something that would be more closely convenient to them, but I've never had anybody say no to that. But what I have done by giving a date, asking people to respond, is I have created a level of urgency to that request. I have given it value. Because if I just give it to somebody, just kind of pass it off and say, well, here's something I'd like you to consider. You know, God bless you. I hope that you'll consider this. I haven't given it urgency. I haven't given it importance. And the realities are they probably won't either. So I think it's very, very important that we provide these personalized proposals. And the last step is obviously thanking people, sustaining their involvement. And I think we sustain people's involvement by thanking them, number one, by engaging them in an ongoing way in the support of our organization, number two, and by maintaining communication with them, number three. It's very, very important that despite the fact that somebody gives to us, that they kind of assume that they've, you know, their value, if we don't put value to sustaining and thanking people, they perceive they've been manipulated because now that you've given them or they've given you what it is you've asked for, you don't ever talk to them again. And the realities are that's the only the beginning of the relationship. And so you need to think about how you thank people. You need to think about how you can continue to engage people after their commitment to become involved and engaged in your ministry, and you need to think of ongoing ways to communicate with them the ongoing ministry that you're a part of, because they have chosen now to be a partner with you. The first gift is important to your organization. The second gift is critical to sustaining. Okay, did you hear that? The first gift is important to your organization. The second gift is critical to your ability to be able to sustain the support of an individual. And so I think the second appeal for help needs to occur probably, you know, within close proximity to the first appeal to allow people to know that their ongoing involvement is absolutely critical to your ability to succeed. Okay, we're going to leave that. You've been patient. Thanks for taking a little bit extra time. It's time to eat. And so rush to the Paranoia Hotel. Oh, not yet. Oh, we have another assignment.